There was no single answer, but rather a multitude. For lung cancer, the driver of decline was primarily prevention. A slow attrition in smoking, sparked off by the Dahl Hill and Winder Graham studies, fueled by the Surgeon General's report, and brought to its full boil by a combination of political activism, the FTC action on warning labels, inventive litigation, the Banzhaf and Cipollone cases, medical advocacy, and counter-marketing, the anti-tobacco advertisements. For colon and cervical cancer, the declines were almost certainly due to the successes of secondary prevention, cancer screening. Colon cancers were detected at earlier and earlier stages in their evolution, often in the pre-malignant state, and treated with relatively minor surgeries. Cervical cancer screening, using Papanikolaou's smearing technique, was being offered at primary care centers throughout the nation. And as with colon cancer, pre-malignant lesions were excised using relatively minor surgeries. For leukemia, lymphoma, and testicular cancer, in contrast, the declining numbers reflected the successes of chemotherapeutic treatment. In childhood ALL, cure rates of 80% were routinely being achieved. Hodgkin's disease was similarly curable, and so too were some large-cell aggressive lymphomas. Indeed, for Hodgkin's disease, testicular cancer, and childhood leukemias, the burning question was not how much chemotherapy was curative, but how little. Trials were addressing whether milder and less toxic doses of drugs, scaled back from the original protocols, could achieve equivalent cure rates. Perhaps most symbolically, the decline in breast cancer mortality epitomized the cumulative and collaborative nature of these victories, and the importance of attacking cancer using multiple independent prongs. Between 1990 and 2005, breast cancer mortality had dwindled an unprecedented 24%. Three interventions had potentially driven down the breast cancer death rate: mammography, screening to catch early breast cancer and thereby prevent invasive breast cancer, surgery, and adjuvant chemotherapy, chemotherapy after surgery, to remove remnant cancer cells. Donald Berry, a statistician in Houston, Texas, set out to answer a controversial question: how much had mammography and chemotherapy independently contributed to survival? Whose victory was this, a victory of prevention or of therapeutic intervention? Surgery's contribution could not be judged, since surgery predated 1990, and nearly all women are treated surgically. Berry's answer was a long-due emollient to a field beset by squabbles between the advocates of prevention and the proponents of chemotherapy. When Berry assessed the effect of each intervention independently using statistical models, it was a satisfying tie. Both cancer prevention and chemotherapy had diminished breast cancer mortality equally, 12% for mammography and 12% for chemotherapy, adding up to the observed 24% reduction in mortality. No one, as Berry said, paraphrasing the Bible, had labored in vain. These were all deep, audacious, and meaningful victories born on the backs of deep and meaningful labors. But in truth, they were the victories of another generation, the result of discoveries made in the 50s and 60s. The core conceptual advances from which these treatment strategies arose predated nearly all the significant work on the cell biology of cancer. In a bewildering spurt over just two decades, scientists had unveiled a fantastical new world of errant oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes that accelerated and decelerated growth to unleash cancer, of chromosomes that could be decapitated and translocated to create new genetic chimeras, of cellular pathways corrupted to subvert the death of cancer. But the therapeutic advances that had led to the slow attrition of cancer mortality made no use of this novel biology of cancer. There was new science on one hand and old medicine on the other. Mary Lasker had once searched for an epical shift in cancer, but the shift that had occurred seemed to belong to another epoch. Mary Lasker died of heart failure in 1994 in her carefully curated home in Connecticut, having removed herself physically from the bristling epicenters of cancer research and policymaking in Washington, New York, and Boston. She was 93 years old. Her life had nearly spanned the most transformative and turbulent century of biomedical science. Her potent ebullience had dimmed in her last decade. She spoke rarely about the achievements, or disappointments, of the war on cancer. But she had expected cancer medicine to have achieved more during her lifetime, to have taken a more assertive step toward Farber's universal cure for cancer, and marked a more definitive victory in the war. The complexity, the tenacity, the sheer magisterial force of cancer had made even its most committed and resolute opponent seem circumspect and humbled. In 1994, a few months after Lasker's death, the cancer geneticist Ed Harlow captured both the agony and the ecstasy of the era. At the end of a week-long conference at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York, pervaded by a giddy sense of anticipation about the spectacular achievements of cancer biology, Harlow delivered a sobering assessment. "Our knowledge of molecular defects in cancer has come from a dedicated 20 years of the best molecular biology research. Yet this information does not translate to any effective treatments, nor to any understanding of why many of the current treatments succeed or why others fail. It is a frustrating time." More than a decade later, I could sense the same frustration in the clinic at Mass General. One afternoon, I watched Tom Lynch, the lung cancer clinician, masterfully encapsulate carcinogenesis, cancer genetics, and chemotherapy for a new patient, a middle-aged woman with bronchoalveolar cell cancer. She was a professor of history with a grave manner and a sharp, darting mind. He sat across from her, scribbling a picture as he spoke. "The cells in her bronchus," he began, "had acquired mutations in their genes that allowed them to grow autonomously and uncontrollably. They had formed a local tumor. Their propensity was to acquire further mutations that might allow them to migrate, to invade tissues, to metastasize. Chemotherapy with carboplatin and Taxol, two standard chemotherapy drugs, augmented with radiation, would kill the cells and perhaps prevent them from migrating to other organs to seed metastases. In the best-case scenario, the cells carrying the mutated genes would die and her cancer would be cured." She watched Lynch put his pen down with her quick, sharp eyes. The explanation sounded logical and organized, but she had caught the glint of a broken piece in the chain of logic. What was the connection between the explanation and the therapy being proposed? How, she wanted to know, would carboplatin fix her mutated genes? How would Taxol know which cells carried the mutations in order to kill them? How would the mechanistic explanation of her illness connect with the medical interventions? She had captured a disjunction all too familiar to oncologists. For nearly a decade, practicing cancer medicine had become like living inside a pressurized can. Pushed, on one hand, by the increasing force of biological clarity about cancer, but then pressed against the wall of medical stagnation that seemed to have produced no real medicines out of this biological clarity. In the winter of 1945, Vannevar Bush had written to President Roosevelt, "The striking advances in medicine during the war have been possible only because we had a large backlog of scientific data accumulated through basic research in many scientific fields in the years before the war." For cancer, the backlog of scientific data had reached a critical point. The boil of science, as Bush liked to imagine it, inevitably produced a kind of steam, an urgent rhapsodic pressure that could only find release in technology. Cancer science was begging to find release in a new kind of cancer medicine. New drugs for old cancers. In the story of Patroclus, no one survives, not even Achilles, who was nearly a god. Patroclus resembled him. They wore the same armor. Louise Gluck. The perfect therapy has not been developed. Most of us believe that it will not involve toxic cytotoxic therapy, which is why we support the kinds of basic investigations that are directed towards more fundamental understanding of tumor biology. But we must do the best with what we now have. Bruce Chabner to Rose Kushner. In the legend, Achilles was quickly dipped into the river Styx, held up only by the tendon of his heel. Touched by the dark sheath of water, every part of his body was instantly rendered impervious to even the most lethal weapon, except the undipped tendon. A simple arrow targeted to that vulnerable heel would eventually kill Achilles in the battlefields of Troy. Before the 1980s, the armamentarium of cancer therapy was largely built around two fundamental vulnerabilities of cancer cells. The first is that most cancers originate as local diseases before they spread systemically. Surgery and radiation therapy exploit this vulnerability. By physically excising locally restricted tumors before cancer cells can spread, or by searing cancer cells with localized bursts of powerful energy using X-rays, surgery and radiation attempt to eliminate cancer en bloc from the body. The second vulnerability is the rapid growth rate of cancer cells. Most chemotherapy drugs discovered before the 1980s target this second vulnerability. Antifolates, such as Farber's aminopterin, interrupt the metabolism of folic acid and starve all cells of a crucial nutrient required for cell division. Nitrogen mustard and cisplatin chemically react with DNA, and DNA-damaged cells cannot duplicate their genes and thus cannot divide. Vincristine, the periwinkle poison, thwarts the ability of a cell to construct the molecular scaffold required for all cells to divide. But these two traditional Achilles heels of cancer, local growth and rapid cell division, can only be targeted to a point. Surgery and radiation are intrinsically localized strategies, and they fail when cancer cells have spread beyond the limits of what can be surgically removed or irradiated. More surgery thus does not lead to more cures, as the radical surgeons discovered to their despair in the 1950s. Targeting cellular growth also hits a biological ceiling, because normal cells must grow as well. Growth may be the hallmark of cancer, but it is equally the hallmark of life. A poison directed at cellular growth, such as vincristine or cisplatin, eventually attacks normal growth, and cells that grow most rapidly in the body begin to bear the collateral cost of chemotherapy. Hair falls out, blood involutes, the lining of the skin and gut sloughs off. More drugs produce more toxicity without producing cures, as the radical chemotherapists discovered to their despair in the 1980s. To target cancer cells with novel therapies, scientists and physicians needed new vulnerabilities that were unique to cancer. The discoveries of cancer biology in the 1980s offered a vastly more nuanced view of these vulnerabilities. Three new principles emerged, representing three new Achilles heels of cancer. First, cancer cells are driven to grow because of the accumulation of mutations in their DNA. These mutations activate internal proto-oncogenes and inactivate tumor suppressor genes, thus unleashing the accelerators and brakes that operate during normal cell division. Targeting these hyperactive genes, while sparing their modulated normal precursors, might be a novel means to attack cancer cells more discriminately. Second, proto-oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes typically lie at the hubs of cellular signaling pathways. Cancer cells divide and grow because they are driven by hyperactive or inactive signals in these critical pathways. These pathways exist in normal cells, but are tightly regulated. The potential dependence of a cancer cell on such permanently activated pathways is a second potential vulnerability of a cancer cell. Third, the relentless cycle of mutation, selection, and survival creates a cancer cell that has acquired several additional properties besides uncontrolled growth. These include the capacity to resist death signals, to metastasize throughout the body, and to incite the growth of blood vessels. These hallmarks of cancer are not invented by the cancer cell. They are typically derived from the corruption of similar processes that occur in the normal physiology of the body. The acquired dependence of a cancer cell on these processes is a third potential vulnerability of cancer. The central therapeutic challenge of the newest cancer medicine, then, was to find, among the vast numbers of similarities in normal cells and cancer cells, subtle differences in genes, pathways, and acquired capabilities, and to drive a poisoned stake into that new heel. It was one thing to identify an Achilles heel, and quite another to discover a weapon that would strike it. Until the late 1980s, no drug had reversed an oncogene's activation or a tumor suppressor's inactivation. Even tamoxifen, the most specific cancer-targeted drug discovered to that date, works by attacking the dependence of certain breast cancer cells on estrogen, and not by directly inactivating an oncogene or oncogene-activated pathway. In 1986, the discovery of the first oncogene-targeted drug would thus instantly galvanize cancer medicine. Although found largely serendipitously, the mere existence of such a molecule would set the stage for the vast drug-hunting efforts of the next decade. The disease that stood at the pivotal crossroads of oncology was yet another rare variant of leukemia, called acute promyelocytic leukemia, APL. First identified as a distinct form of adult leukemia in the 1950s, the disease has a distinct characteristic. The cells in this form of cancer do not merely divide rapidly, they are also strikingly frozen in immature development. Normal white blood cells developing in the bone marrow undergo a series of maturational steps to develop into fully functional adult cells. One such intermediate cell is termed a promyelocyte, an adolescent cell on the verge of becoming functionally mature. APL is characterized by the malignant proliferation of these immature promyelocytes. Normal promyelocytes are loaded with toxic enzymes and granules that are usually released by adult white blood cells to kill viruses, bacteria, and parasites. In promyelocytic leukemia, the blood fills up with these toxin-loaded promyelocytes. Moody, mercurial, and jumpy, the cells of APL can release their poisonous granules on a whim, precipitating massive bleeding or simulating a septic reaction in the body. In APL, the pathological proliferation of cancer thus comes with a fiery twist. Most cancers contain cells that refuse to stop growing. In APL, the cancer cells also refuse to grow up. Since the early 1970s, this maturation arrest of APL cells had prompted scientists to hunt for a chemical that might force these cells to mature. Scores of drugs had been tested on APL cells in test tubes, and only one had stood out: retinoic acid, an oxidized form of vitamin A. But retinoic acid, researchers had found, was a vexingly unreliable reagent. One batch of the acid might mature APL cells, while another batch of the same chemical might fail. Frustrated by these flickering, unfathomable responses, biologists and chemists had turned away after their initial enthusiasm for the maturation chemical. In the summer of 1985, a team of leukemia researchers from China traveled to France to meet Laurent Degas, a hematologist at St. Louis Hospital in Paris with a long-standing interest in APL. The Chinese team, led by Zhen Yi Wang, was also treating APL patients at Ruijin Hospital, a busy urban clinical center in Shanghai, China. Both Degas and Wang had tried standard chemotherapy agents, drugs that target rapidly growing cells, to promote remissions in APL patients. But the results had been dismal. Wang and Degas spoke of the need for a new strategy to attack this whimsical, lethal disease, and they kept circling back to the peculiar immaturity of APL cells and to the lapsed search for a maturation agent for the disease. Retinoic acid, Wang and Degas knew, comes in two closely related molecular forms called cis-retinoic acid and trans-retinoic acid. The two forms are compositionally identical, but possess a slight difference in their molecular structure, and they behave very differently in molecular reactions. Cis-retinoic acid and trans-retinoic acid have the same atoms, but the atoms are arranged differently in the two chemicals. Of the two forms, cis-retinoic acid had been the most intensively tested, and it had produced the flickering transient responses. But Wang and Degas wondered if trans-retinoic acid was the true maturation agent. Had the unreliable responses in the old experiments been due to a low and variable amount of the trans-retinoic form present in every batch of retinoic acid? Wang, who had studied at a French Jesuit school in Shanghai, spoke a lilting, heavily accented French. Linguistic and geographic barriers breached, the two hematologists outlined an international collaboration. Wang knew of a pharmaceutical factory outside Shanghai that could produce pure trans-retinoic acid, without the admixture of cis-retinoic acid. He would test the drug on APL patients at the Ruijin Hospital. Degas's team in Paris would follow after the initial round of testing in China and further validate the strategy on French APL patients. Wang launched his trial in 1986 with 24 patients. 23 experienced a dazzling response. Leukemic promyelocytes in the blood underwent a brisk maturation into white blood cells. The nucleus became larger, Wang wrote, and fewer primary granules were observed in the cytoplasm. On the fourth day of culture, these cells gave rise to myelocytes containing specific or secondary granules, indicating the development of fully mature granulocytes. Then something even more unexpected occurred. Having fully matured, the cancer cells began to die out. In some patients, the differentiation and death erupted so volcanically that the bone marrow swelled up with differentiated promyelocytes and then emptied slowly over weeks as the cancer cells matured and underwent an accelerated cycle of death. The sudden maturation of cancer cells produced a short-lived metabolic disarray, which was controlled with medicines. But the only other side effects of trans-retinoic acid were dryness of lips and mouth and an occasional rash. The remissions produced by trans-retinoic acid lasted weeks and often months. Acute promyelocytic leukemia still relapsed, typically about 3 to 4 months after treatment with trans-retinoic acid. The Paris and Shanghai teams next combined standard chemotherapy drugs with trans-retinoic acid, a cocktail of old and new drugs, and remissions were prolonged by several additional months. In about 3/4 of the patients, the leukemia remission began to stretch into a full year, then into 5 years. By 1993, Wang and Degas concluded that 75% of their patients treated with the combination of trans-retinoic acid and standard chemotherapy would never relapse, a percentage unheard of in the history of APL. Cancer biologists would need another decade to explain the startling Ruijin responses at a molecular level. The key to the explanation lay in the elegant studies performed by Janet Rowley, the Chicago cytologist. In 1984, Rowley had identified a unique translocation in the chromosomes of APL cells. A fragment of a gene from chromosome 15 fused with a fragment of a gene from chromosome 17. This created an activated chimeric oncogene that drove the proliferation of promyelocytes and blocked their maturation, thus creating the peculiar syndrome of APL. In 1990, a full 4 years after Wang's clinical trial in Shanghai, the culprit oncogene was isolated by independent teams of scientists from France, Italy, and America. The APL oncogene, scientists found, encodes a protein that is tightly bound by trans-retinoic acid. This binding immediately extinguishes the oncogene signal in APL cells, thereby explaining the rapid, powerful remissions observed in Shanghai. The Ruijin discovery was remarkable. Transretinoic acid represented the long-sought fantasy of molecular oncology, an oncogene-targeted cancer drug. But the discovery was a fantasy lived backward. Wang and Degas had first stumbled on transretinoic acid through inspired guesswork, and only later discovered that the molecule could directly target an oncogene. But was it possible to make the converse journey, starting from oncogene and going to drug? Indeed, Robert Weinberg's lab in Boston had already begun that converse journey, although Weinberg himself was largely oblivious of it. By the early 1980s, Weinberg's lab had perfected a technique to isolate cancer-causing genes directly out of cancer cells. Using Weinberg's technique, researchers had isolated dozens of new oncogenes from cancer cells. In 1982, a postdoctoral scientist from Bombay working in Weinberg's lab, Lakshmi Charan Patti, reported the isolation of yet another such oncogene from a rat tumor called a neuroblastoma. Weinberg christened the gene Nu, naming it after the type of cancer that harbored this gene. Nu was added to the growing list of oncogenes, but it was an anomaly. Cells are bounded by a thin membrane of lipids and proteins that acts as an oily barrier against the entry of many drugs. Most oncogenes discovered thus far, such as RAS and MYC, are sequestered inside the cell. RAS is bound to the cell membrane but faces into the cell, making them inaccessible to drugs that cannot penetrate the cell membrane. The product of the new gene, in contrast, was a novel protein, not hidden deep inside the cell, but tethered to the cell membrane with a large fragment that hung outside, freely accessible to any drug. Lakshmi Charan Patti even had a drug to test. In 1981, while isolating his gene, he had created an antibody against the new protein. Antibodies are molecules designed to bind to other molecules, and the binding can occasionally block and inactivate the bound protein. But antibodies are unable to cross the cell membrane and need an exposed protein outside the cell to bind. Nu, then, was a perfect target, with a large portion, a long molecular foot, projected tantalizingly outside the cell membrane. It would have taken Patti no more than an afternoon's experiment to add the Nu antibody to the neuroblastoma cells to determine the binding's effect. It would have been an overnight test, Weinberg would later recall. I can flagellate myself. If I had been more studious and more focused and not as monomaniacal about the idea I had at that time, I would have made that connection. Despite the trail of seductive leads, Patti and Weinberg never got around to doing their experiment. Afternoon upon afternoon passed. Introspective and bookish, Patti shuffled through the lab in a threadbare coat in the winter, running his experiments privately and saying little about them to others. And although Patti's discovery was published in a high-profile scientific journal, few scientists noticed that he might have stumbled on a potential anti-cancer drug. The new binding antibody was buried in an obscure figure in the article. Even Weinberg, caught in the giddy upswirl of new oncogenes and obsessed with the basic biology of the cancer cell, simply forgot about the new experiment. In 1986, Jeffrey Drebin and Mark Green showed that treatment with an anti-Nu antibody arrested the growth of cancer cells. But the prospect of developing this antibody into a human anti-cancer drug eluded all groups. Weinberg had an oncogene and possibly an oncogene-blocking drug, but the twain had never met, in human cells or bodies. In the neuroblastoma cells dividing in his incubators, Nu rampaged on monomaniacally, single-mindedly, seemingly invincible. Yet its molecular foot still waved just outside the surface of the plasma membrane, exposed and vulnerable, like Achilles' famous heel. A City of Strings. In Ercilia, to establish the relationships that sustain the city's life, inhabitants stretch strings from the corners of the houses, white or black or gray or black and white, according to whether they mark a relationship of blood, of trade, authority, agency. When the strings become so numerous that you can no longer pass among them, the inhabitants leave, the houses are dismantled. Italo Calvino. Weinberg may briefly have forgotten about the therapeutic implication of new, but oncogenes, by their very nature, could not easily be forgotten. In his book, Invisible Cities, Italo Calvino describes a fictional metropolis in which every relationship between one household and the next is denoted by a piece of colored string stretched between the two houses. As the metropolis grows, the mesh of strings thickens and the individual houses blur away. In the end, Calvino's city becomes no more than an interwoven network of colored strings. If someone were to draw a similar map of relationships among genes in a normal human cell, then proto-oncogenes and tumor suppressors, such as RAS, MYC, Nu, and RB, would sit at the hub of this cellular city, radiating webs of colored strings in every direction. Proto-oncogenes and tumor suppressors are the molecular pivots of the cell. They are the gatekeepers of cell division, and the division of cells is so central to our physiology that genes and pathways that coordinate this process intersect with nearly every other aspect of our biology. In the laboratory, we call this the 6 degrees of separation from cancer rule. You can ask any biological question, no matter how seemingly distant. What makes the heart fail? Or why worms age? Or even how birds learn songs? And you will end up, in fewer than 6 genetic steps, connecting with a proto-oncogene or tumor suppressor. It should hardly come as a surprise, then, that Nu was barely forgotten in Weinberg's laboratory when it was resurrected in another. In the summer of 1984, a team of researchers, collaborating with Weinberg, discovered the human homologue of the Nu gene. Noting its resemblance to another growth-modulating gene discovered previously, the human EGF receptor, HER, the researchers called the gene HER2. A gene by any other name may still be the same gene, but something crucial had shifted in the story of Nu. Weinberg's gene had been discovered in an academic laboratory. Much of Weinberg's attention had been focused on dissecting the molecular mechanism of the Nu oncogene. HER2, in contrast, was discovered on the sprawling campus of the pharmaceutical company Genentech. The difference in venue and the resulting difference in goals would radically alter the fate of this gene. For Weinberg, Nu had represented a route to understanding the fundamental biology of neuroblastoma. For Genentech, HER2 represented a route to developing a new drug. Located on the southern edge of San Francisco, sandwiched among the powerhouse labs of Stanford, UCSF, and Berkeley, and the burgeoning startups of Silicon Valley, Genentech, short for Genetic Engineering Technology, was born out of an idea imbued with deep alchemic symbolism. In the late 1970s, researchers at Stanford and UCSF had invented a technology termed recombinant DNA. This technology allowed genes to be manipulated, engineered, in a hitherto unimaginable manner. Genes could be shuttled from one organism to another. A cow gene could be transferred into bacteria, or a human protein synthesized in dog cells. Genes could also be spliced together to create new genes, creating proteins never found in nature. Genentech imagined leveraging this technology of genes to develop a pharmacopoeia of novel drugs. Founded in 1976, the company licensed recombinant DNA technology from UCSF, raised a paltry $200,000 in venture funds, and launched its hunt for these novel drugs. A drug, in bare conceptual terms, is any substance that can produce an effect on the physiology of an animal. Drugs can be simple molecules. Water and salt, under appropriate circumstances, can function as potent pharmacological agents. Or drugs can be complex, multifaceted chemicals. Molecules derived from nature, such as penicillin, or chemicals synthesized artificially, such as aminopterin. Among the most complex drugs in medicine are proteins, molecules synthesized by cells that can exert diverse effects on human physiology. Insulin, made by pancreas cells, is a protein that regulates blood sugar and can be used to control diabetes. Growth hormone, made by the pituitary cells, augments growth by increasing the metabolism of muscle and bone cells. Before Genentech, protein drugs, although recognizably potent, had been notoriously difficult to produce. Insulin, for instance, was produced by grinding up cow and pig innards into a soup and then extracting the protein from the mix. 1 pound of insulin from every 8,000 pounds of pancreas. Growth hormone, used to treat a form of dwarfism, was extracted from pituitary glands dissected out of thousands of human cadavers. Clotting drugs to treat bleeding disorders came from liters of human blood. Recombinant DNA technology allowed Genentech to synthesize human proteins de novo, rather than extracting proteins from animal and human organs. Genentech could engineer a human gene into a bacterium, say, and use the bacterial cell as a bioreactor to produce vast quantities of that protein. The technology was transformative. In 1982, Genentech unveiled the first recombinant human insulin. In 1984, it produced a clotting factor used to control bleeding in patients with hemophilia. In 1985, it created a recombinant version of human growth hormone, all created by engineering the production of human proteins in bacterial or animal cells. By the late 1980s, though, after an astonishing growth spurt, Genentech ran out of existing drugs to mass produce using recombinant technology. Its early victories, after all, had been the result of a process and not a product. The company had found a radical new way to produce old medicines. Now, as Genentech set out to invent new drugs from scratch, it was forced to change its winning strategy. It needed to find targets for drugs, proteins in cells that might play a critical role in the physiology of a disease that might, in turn, be turned on or off by other proteins produced using recombinant DNA. It was under the aegis of this target discovery program that Axel Ulrich, a German scientist working at Genentech, rediscovered Weinberg's gene. HER2 knew, the oncogene tethered to the cell membrane. Ulrich actually found the human homologue of the mouse new gene. Two other groups independently discovered the same gene. But having discovered the gene, Genentech did not know what to do with it. The drugs that Genentech had successfully synthesized thus far were designed to treat human diseases in which a protein or a signal was absent or low. Insulin for diabetics, clotting factors for hemophiliacs, growth hormone for dwarfs. An oncogene was the opposite. Not a missing signal, but a signal in overabundance. Genentech could fabricate a missing protein in bacterial cells, but it had yet to learn how to inactivate a hyperactive protein in a human cell. In the summer of 1986, while Genentech was still puzzling over a method to inactivate oncogenes, Ulrich presented a seminar at the University of California in Los Angeles. Flamboyant and exuberant, dressed in a dark formal suit, Ulrich was a riveting speaker. He floored his audience with the incredible story of the isolation of HER2 and the serendipitous convergence of that discovery with Weinberg's prior work. But he left his listeners searching for a punchline. Genentech was a drug company. Where was the drug? Dennis Slaman, a UCLA oncologist, attended Ulrich's talk that afternoon in 1986. The son of an Appalachian coal miner, Slaman had come to UCLA as a fellow in oncology after medical school at the University of Chicago. He was a peculiar amalgam of smoothness and tenacity, a velvet jackhammer, as one reporter described him. Early in his academic life, he had acquired what he called a murderous resolve to cure cancer. But thus far, it was all resolve and no result. In Chicago, Slayman had performed a series of exquisite studies on a human leukemia virus called HTLV-1, the lone retrovirus shown to cause a human cancer. But HTLV-1 was a fleetingly rare cause of cancer. Murdering viruses, Slayman knew, would not cure cancer. He needed a method to kill an oncogene. Slayman, hearing Ulrich's story of HER2, made a quick, intuitive connection. Ulrich had an oncogene. Genentech wanted a drug, but an intermediate was missing. A drug without a disease is a useless tool. To make a worthwhile cancer drug, both needed a cancer in which the HER2 gene was hyperactive. Slayman had a panel of cancers that he could test for HER2 hyperactivity. A compulsive pack rat, like Thad Dreija in Boston, Slayman had been collecting and storing samples of cancer tissues from patients who had undergone surgery at UCLA, all saved in a vast freezer. Slayman proposed a simple collaboration. If Ulrich sent him the DNA probes for HER2 from Genentech, Slayman could test his collection of cancer cells for samples with hyperactive HER2, thus bridging the gap between the oncogene and a human cancer. Ulrich agreed. In 1986, he sent Slayman the HER2 probe to test on cancer samples. In a few months, Slayman reported back to Ulrich that he had found a distinct pattern, although he did not fully understand it. Cancer cells that became habitually dependent on the activity of a gene for their growth can amplify that gene by making multiple copies of the gene in the chromosome. This phenomenon, like an addict feeding an addiction by ramping up the use of a drug, is called oncogene amplification. HER2, Slayman found, was highly amplified in breast cancer samples, but not in all breast cancers. Based on the pattern of staining, breast cancers could neatly be divided into HER2 amplified and HER2 unamplified samples, HER2 positive and HER2 negative. Puzzled by the on-off pattern, Slayman sent an assistant to determine whether HER2 positive tumors behaved differently from HER2 negative tumors. The search yielded yet another extraordinary pattern. Breast tumors that amplified Ulrich's gene tended to be more aggressive, more metastatic, and more likely to kill. HER2 amplification marked the tumors with the worst prognosis. Slayman's data set off a chain reaction in Ulrich's lab at Genentech. The association of HER2 with a subtype of cancer, aggressive breast cancer, prompted an important experiment. What would happen, Ulrich wondered, if HER2 activity could somehow be shut off? Was the cancer truly addicted to amplified HER2? And if so, might squelching the addiction signal using an anti-HER2 drug block the growth of the cancer cells? Ulrich was tiptoeing around the afternoon experiment that Weinberg and Patty had forgotten to perform. Ulrich knew where he might look for a drug to shut off HER2 function. By the mid-1980s, Genentech had organized itself into an astonishing simulacrum of a university. The South San Francisco campus had departments, conferences, lectures, subgroups, even researchers in cut-off jeans playing frisbee on the lawns. One afternoon, Ulrich walked to the immunology division at Genentech. The division specialized in the creation of immunological molecules. Ulrich wondered whether someone in immunology might be able to design a drug to bind HER2 and possibly erase its signaling. Ulrich had a particular kind of protein in mind, an antibody. Antibodies are immunological proteins that bind their targets with exquisite affinity and specificity. The immune system synthesizes antibodies to bind and kill specific targets on bacteria and viruses. Antibodies are nature's magic bullets. In the mid-1970s, two immunologists at Cambridge University, Cesar Milstein and George Kohler, had devised a method to produce vast quantities of a single antibody using a hybrid immune cell that had been physically fused to a cancer cell. The immune cell secreted the antibody while the cancer cell, a specialist in uncontrolled growth, turned it into a factory. The discovery had instantly been hailed as a potential route to a cancer cure. But to exploit antibodies therapeutically, scientists needed to identify targets unique to cancer cells, and such cancer-specific targets had proved notoriously difficult to identify. Ulrich believed that he had found one such target. HER2, amplified in some breast tumors but barely visible in normal cells, was perhaps Kohler's missing bullseye. At UCLA, meanwhile, Slaman had performed another crucial experiment with HER2-expressing cancers. He had implanted these cancers into mice, where they had exploded into friable metastatic tumors, recapitulating the aggressive human disease. In 1988, Genentech's immunologists successfully produced a mouse antibody that bound and inactivated HER2. Ulrich sent Slaman the first vials of the antibody, and Slaman launched a series of pivotal experiments. When he treated HER2 overexpressing breast cancer cells in a dish with the antibody, the cells stopped growing, then involuted, and died. More impressively, when he injected his living, tumor-bearing mice with the HER2 antibody, the tumors also disappeared. It was as perfect a result as he or Ulrich could have hoped for. HER2 inhibition worked in an animal model. Slaman and Ulrich now had all three essential ingredients for a targeted therapy for cancer: an oncogene, a form of cancer that specifically activated that oncogene, and a drug that specifically targeted it. Both expected Genentech to leap at the opportunity to produce a new protein drug to erase an oncogene's hyperactive signal. But Ulrich, holed away in his lab with HER2, had lost touch with the trajectory of the company outside the lab. Genentech, he now discovered, was abandoning its interest in cancer. Through the 1980s, as Ulrich and Slaman had been hunting for a target specific to cancer cells, several other pharmaceutical companies had tried to develop anti-cancer drugs using the limited knowledge of the mechanisms driving the growth of cancer cells. Predictably, the drugs that had emerged were largely indiscriminate, toxic to both cancer cells and normal cells, and, predictably, all had failed miserably in clinical trials. Ulrich and Slaman's approach, an oncogene and an oncogene-targeted antibody, was vastly more sophisticated and specific, but Genentech was worried that pouring money into the development of another drug that failed would cripple the company's finances. Chastened by the experience of others, allergic to cancer, as one Genentech researcher described it, Genentech pulled funding away from most of its cancer projects. The decision created a deep rift in the company. A small cadre of scientists ardently supported the cancer program, but Genentech's executives wanted to focus on simpler and more profitable drugs. HER2 was caught in the crossfire. Drained and dejected, Ulrich left Genentech. He would eventually join an academic laboratory in Germany, where he could work on cancer genetics without the fickle pressures of a pharmaceutical company constraining his science. Slaman, now working alone at UCLA, tried furiously to keep the HER2 effort alive at Genentech, even though he wasn't on the company's payroll. "Nobody gave a shit except him," John Kurd, Genentech's medical director, recalled. Slaman became a pariah at Genentech, a pushy, obsessed gadfly who would often jet up from Los Angeles and lurk in the corridors, seeking to interest anyone he could in his mouse antibody. Most scientists had lost interest, but Slaman retained the faith of a small group of Genentech scientists, scientists nostalgic for the pioneering early days of Genentech, when problems had been taken on precisely because they were intractable. An MIT-educated geneticist, David Botstein, and a molecular biologist, Art Levinson, both at Genentech, had been strong proponents of the HER2 project. Levinson had come to Genentech from Michael Bishop's lab at UCSF, where he had worked on the phosphorylating function of SARC. Oncogenes were stitched into his psyche. Pulling strings, resources, and connections, Slaman and Levinson convinced a tiny entrepreneurial team to push ahead with the HER2 project. Marginally funded, the work edged along, almost invisible to Genentech's executives. In 1989, Mike Shepard, an immunologist at Genentech, improved the production and purification of the HER2 antibody. But the purified mouse antibody, Slamon knew, was far from a human drug. Mouse antibodies, being foreign proteins, provoke a potent immune response in humans and make terrible human drugs. To circumvent that response, Genentech's antibody needed to be converted into a protein that more closely resembled a human antibody. This process, evocatively called humanizing an antibody, is a delicate art, somewhat akin to translating a novel. What matters is not just the content, but the ineffable essence of the antibody, its form. Genentech's resident humanizer was Paul Carter, a quiet 29-year-old Englishman who had learned the craft at Cambridge from Cesar Milstein, the scientist who had first produced these antibodies using fused immune and cancer cells. Under Slamon's and Shepard's guidance, Carter set about humanizing the mouse antibody. In the summer of 1990, Carter proudly produced a fully humanized HER2 antibody ready to be used in clinical trials. The antibody, now a potential drug, would soon be renamed Herceptin, fusing the words HER2, intercept, and inhibitor. The drug is also known by its pharmacological name, trastuzumab. The ab suffix is used to denote the fact that this is an antibody. Such was the halting, traumatic birth of the new drug that it was easy to forget the enormity of what had been achieved. Slamon had identified HER2 amplification in breast cancer tissue in 1987. Carter and Shepard had produced a humanized antibody against it by 1990. They had moved from cancer to target to drug in an astonishing 3 years, a pace unprecedented in the history of cancer. In the summer of 1990, Barbara Bradfield, a 48-year-old woman from Burbank, California, discovered a mass in her breast and a lump under her arm. A biopsy confirmed what she already suspected. She had breast cancer that had spread to her lymph nodes. She was treated with a bilateral mastectomy, followed by nearly 7 months of chemotherapy. "When I was finished with all that," she recalled, "I felt as if I had crossed a river of tragedy." But there was more river to ford. Bradfield's life was hit by yet another incommensurate tragedy. In the winter of 1991, driving on a highway not far from their house, her daughter, 23 years old and pregnant, was killed in a fiery accident. A few months later, sitting numbly in a Bible study class one morning, Bradfield let her fingers wander up to the edge of her neck. A new grape-sized mass had appeared just above her collarbone. Her breast cancer had relapsed and metastasized, almost certainly a harbinger of death. Bradfield's oncologist in Burbank offered her more chemotherapy, but she declined it. She enrolled in an alternative herbal therapy program and bought a vegetable juicer and planned a trip to Mexico. When her oncologist asked if he could send samples of her breast cancer to Slamon's lab at UCLA for a second opinion, she agreed reluctantly. A faraway doctor performing unfamiliar tests on her tumor sample, she knew, could not possibly affect her. One afternoon in the summer of 1991, Bradfield received a phone call from Slamon. He introduced himself as a researcher who had been analyzing her slides. Slamon told Bradfield about HER2. His tone changed, she recalled. Her tumor, he said, had one of the highest levels of amplified HER2 that he had ever seen. Slamon told her that he was launching a trial of an antibody that would bound HER2, and that she would be the ideal candidate for the new drug. Bradfield refused. "I was at the end of my road," she said, "and I had accepted what seemed inevitable." Slamon tried to reason with her for a while, but found her unbending. He thanked her for her consideration and rang off. Early the next morning, though, Slamon was back on the telephone. He apologized for the intrusion, but her decision had troubled him all night. Of all the variants of HER2 amplification that he had encountered, hers had been truly extraordinary. Bradfield's tumor was chock-full of HER2, almost hypnotically drunk on the oncogene. He begged her once again to join his trial. Survivors look back and see omens, messages they missed, Joan Didion wrote. For Bradfield, Slayman's second phone call was an omen that was not missed. Something in that conversation pierced through a shield that she had drawn around herself. On a warm August morning in 1992, Bradfield visited Slayman in his clinic at UCLA. He met her in the hallway and led her to a room in the back. Under the microscope, he showed her the breast cancer that had been excised from her body, with its dark ringlets of HER2 labeled cells. On a whiteboard, he drew a step-by-step picture of an epic scientific journey. He began with the discovery of new, its rediscovery in Ulrich's lab, the struggles to produce a drug, culminating in the antibodies stitched together so carefully by Shepard and Carter. Bradfield considered the line that stretched from oncogene to drug. She agreed to join Slayman's trial. It was an extraordinarily fortunate decision. In the 4 months between Slayman's phone call and the first infusion of Herceptin, Bradfield's tumor had erupted, spraying 16 new masses into her lung. 15 women, including Bradfield, enrolled in Slayman's trial at UCLA in 1992. The number would later be expanded to 37. The drug was given for 9 weeks in combination with cisplatin, a standard chemotherapy agent used to kill breast cancer cells, both delivered intravenously. As a matter of convenience, Slayman planned to treat all the women on the same day and in the same room. The effect was theatrical. This was a stage occupied by a beleaguered set of actors. Some women had begged and finagled their way into Slayman's trial through friends and relatives. Others, such as Bradfield, had been begged to join it. "All of us knew that we were living on borrowed time," Bradfield said, "and so we felt twice as alive and lived twice as fiercely." A Chinese woman in her 50s brought stash after stash of traditional herbs and salves that she swore had kept her alive thus far. She would take oncology's newest drug, Herceptin, only if she could also take its most ancient drugs with it. A frail, thin woman in her 30s, recently relapsed with breast cancer after a bone marrow transplant, glowered silently and intensely in a corner. Some treated their illness reverentially. Some were bewildered, some too embittered to care. A mother from Boston in her mid-50s cracked raunchy jokes about her cancer. The day-long drill of infusions and blood tests was exhausting. In the late evening, after all the tests, the women went their own ways. Bradfield went home and prayed. Another woman soused herself with martinis. The lump on Bradfield's neck, the only tumor in the group that could be physically touched, measured, and watched, became the compass for the trial. On the morning of the first intravenous infusion of the HER2 antibody, all the women came up to feel the lump, one by one, running their hands across Bradfield's collarbone. It was a peculiarly intimate ritual that would be repeated every week. 2 weeks after the first dose of the antibody, when the group filed past Bradfield, touching the node again, the change was incontrovertible. Bradfield's tumor had softened and visibly shrunk. "We began to believe that something was happening here," Bradfield recalled. "Suddenly, the weight of our good fortune hit us." Not everyone was as fortunate as Bradfield. Exhausted and nauseous one evening, the young woman with relapsed metastatic cancer was unable to keep down the fluids needed to hydrate her body. She vomited through the night, and then, too tired to keep drinking and too sick to understand the consequences, fell back into sleep. She died of kidney failure the next week. Bradfield's extraordinary response continued. When the CT scans were repeated 2 months into the trial, the tumor in her neck had virtually disappeared, and the lung metastases had also diminished both in number and size. The responses in many of the 13 other women were more ambiguous. At the 3-month midpoint of the trial, when Slayman reviewed the data with Genentech and the external trial monitors, tough decisions clearly needed to be made. Tumors had remained unchanged in size in some women, not shrunk, but static. Was this to be counted as a positive response? Some women with bone metastasis reported diminished bone pain, but pain could not objectively be judged. After a prolonged and bitter debate, the trial coordinators suggested dropping 7 women from the study because their responses could not be quantified. One woman discontinued the drug herself. Only 4